Can I ask you something? What's your family story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams, your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up, we record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded. My team at East Films is going into production this summer on a Vietnam War period film, and it's made by Vietnamese filmmakers, entirely shot in Vietnam, called Picture House. And our team needs your help. Award-winning director Nguyen Vo Nguyen Minh brings his most personal film to life, a coming-of-age drama inspired by his childhood in Vũng Tàu, where his family ran a movie theater, screening films from all over the world. Our Indiegogo campaign is live through April 30th, and it's a date that marks the 50th anniversary of the end of the war. Your contribution will help this incredible story to the screen. Please support Picture House today by clicking on the links below to the campaign shared in the description. We're back with the Viet cinema canon with Anderson Lai. There's a lot of new filmmakers, and I'm curious why you picked this filmmaker.
Zeng Ziu Lin, right? Or Lin, yeah, I call her Lin Zeng, and like moved to Singapore for university. Always in the art scene, and then she just kind of fell into film.
Yeah.
And worked many, many gigs, jobs, like as a set dresser, editor, or whatnot. And then she slowly kind of went behind the camera as a director. And I think I love her story because she's great. You know, she's, even though she's from Hanoi, she's very Singaporean. I love her sense of humor and her perspective.
Yeah.
And it's very exciting to see. And again, you know, like when it comes to like filmmaking in general, it's very male oriented, right? Like,
yeah.
Think of like, so it's, I mean, in Vietnam, it's like mostly the directors are male. With Lim, it's you know, she brings a unique perspective. And also, what's cool is her artistic journey, because she did the research of like developing her voice as an artist, as a director.
Right.
And like she did research and like entered in various film labs and programs around the world to really, and that's what she did. In our conversation, she talks about how she got in and how the experience was and how it kind of shaped her kind of her vision, her output when it comes to as a filmmaker.
Well, I invite you to join host Anderson Lai with Viet Cinema Canon, and he's going to be talking about Zeng Ziu Lin.
Today, I'm really honored to have this conversation and interview Lin Zeng, who is a Vietnamese filmmaker who is extremely fascinated with sad, angsty, and naggy middle-aged women. That's in her bio. Born in Hanoi, Lin left for Singapore in 2008 when she was 18 to study at the School of Art, Media, and Design, Nanyang Technological University, She would direct several short films that traveled to several prestigious film festivals around the world, all set in Vietnam and with female characters in central roles, and in stories imbued with Lin's quirky sense of humor and at times with genre elements. Director Lin would also travel around the globe, participating in various artists' development programs and labs, such as the Asian Film Academy, the Locarno Summer Academy, Autumn Meeting, Fantastic Film School, Berlinale Talents, and the Screenwriter's Residency at Moulin de Ande. Director Lin completed her first narrative feature, Don't Cry Butterfly, in 2024, where world premiered at the Venice Film Festival and would win the grand prize as part of the Critics Week section.
I think you just mentioned the Fantastic Film School, and I just remember that was when we first met.
Yeah, that's right. At the VFAN, at the Bucheon Fantastic Film,
yes.
Film Festival. Yeah, that was
10 years ago.
A long time ago. Like, yeah. First off, it's been really rewarding for me, especially with your work. You have a quirky sense of humor, especially in everything you do, especially in your bio, where it opens with you know, you're fascinated with sad, angsty, and naggy middle-aged women, and they're very central in your stories. But can you talk about kind of growing up in Hanoi and what inspired you to become a filmmaker? Maybe maybe some of the films or things that you watched and consumed that in that you liked growing up?
Recently, because a lot of people ask me about my childhood, then I start thinking back. Oh, yeah, why did I want to be a filmmaker, and what made me so interested in films? Then I realized that, you know, during the early 2000s, which was when I was like 10 years old, growing to be a teenager, there's a booming industry of like rental DVDs in big cities.
Yes.
So that was when my sister, who was 8 years older than me, she started renting a lot of VCDs. I was into mangas. I was renting like all the mangas books, and then she was renting all the movies. And then she would make me watch with her. You know, some films are definitely not for children under 18 years old. I also, in my class, I happened to sit next to a very rich boy. And that rich boy has a collection of all the cool DVD, like original DVD, not the pirated DVDs.
Sure.
Original DVDs.
Yeah, yeah.
And he would lend me his DVDs to watch. And I still remember till this day, one of the first films that he lent me was Species.
Species, okay. Yes. Yeah, I'm very familiar with Species, especially the alien.
I love it, and I just think back, like, where did my interest in all the horrors and aliens and, you know, like all the weird male female characters come from? And I guess it's from that film because it's one of the rare films I still remember till this day, even the cover.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think because I grew up and I watched a lot of those films, unknowingly, it's just like a form of entertainment, but I think I watched quite a lot, plus my interest in mangas. So I was basically like a geek during my like teenage years. I consume a lot of materials, like visual materials. And when I was in 10th grade, which was when I was 16 years old, there was this competition, WWF. And they were having a competition amongst like high school students. And the competition was to write and direct a 30-second PSA for the TV channel about consuming wildlife. So they were trying to raise awareness among like students level. Right. And so I was one of the...
World Wildlife Foundation.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. I apologize. So, so I was one of the three students that were selected. And then we went on with a filmmaker to learn the basic skills of filmmaking. Mm. But at that time, I still didn't want to be a filmmaker. I went to high school thinking I was going to be a doctor.
Okay.
Because I love operating on animals when I was in secondary school, you know. In secondary school, you have to like operate on earthworm and fish and frogs. So I was very good at that. Okay. And I was very sure that I was going to grow up to be a surgeon. I had a very steady hand.
Oh, okay. Great.
So back then, when I joined that course of filmmaking, I thought it was just for fun. But I did realize that, oh, this is what happened behind the scene. And it's very magical. Like something that outside, when it's come on screen, is totally transformed.
Yeah.
And that was something that I was very fascinated But I didn't think much about it until I was in the final year of my high school and I had to choose which major to go. And I realized that I was actually not very good at chemistry. Mm. And you need to be good at chemistry to be a doctor.
Yeah.
And back then, there was this advertisement for an art school in Singapore. And they had a filmmaking major. And I suddenly thought about that experience I had. And also at that time, I really wanted to just, rebellious teenagers want to get away from family, want to explore the world, feeling like the city is too small for me. So then I just applied for that course to go to Singapore and I got in. And that's why I moved to Singapore for a university.
What was the pitch that for WWF that got you... part of that cohort?
Oh, I still have the clip, actually, if you want to see. I had to dig for it. I can send it to you. Yeah. Sure. I still have the script, the handwritten script. But basically, it's I list out the what people think they would get when they consume wildlife products. Like, they think that they would look very stylish with in like fur coats, or they think that they will earn a lot of money by trading wildlife products. But in the end, I pair it with the images of the animals, me in cages. And it's very simple. It's a very naive idea of a 16-year-old girl. So don't expect too much, but I'll send it to you.
And then, so like, I mean, you look at like species being such a, you know, a significant influence in you know, because it was body horror and whatnot. And like, but what about the manga? What was some of the manga that you were really a big fan of that you consumed?
I consume all kinds of mangas. I love...
there's so many subgenres, right, of manga.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
So I love like high school sport mangas. So I read Slam Dunk, obviously. All mangas by Adachi Mitsuru. Tough Touch, Rough, you know. And I also read, of course, high school love story manga like Sojo. But I read a lot of Sonen manga. And it's like how do I say, like a bit of magical, mystical, like monsters and angels and demons and the realms fighting each other for justice. So like, yeah, strong sense of justice there. I think the mangas shaped my sense of justice in a way, like you have to be a good person. And actually when I was in film school, surprisingly, I didn't start watching a lot of like art house films.
Mm-hmm.
Like then mostly the films I consumed were commercial Hollywood films or Korean films.
Yeah.
But then I think after I graduated from art school and I was in that transition period between being a student and a working life, then I started having a lot of free time.
Yeah.
And I started watching the masters, like all the big names in the cinema world. Chronologically with all their work in one go. So like I would binge watch Kim Ki-duk within 1 week.
Okay.
Or like Hong Sang-soo, all his work within 1 week. So like chunks of directors. Yeah, or like John Carpenter's.
Yeah.
David Cronenberg's.
Uh-huh. Entire tomography in 1 week.
Yeah, not entirely, because sometimes there are films I couldn't find, but I try to watch chronologically because I want to see how they evolve over time. And their obsession, in a way, is quite interesting to watch that way, because you realize, oh, actually, they've been making the same film over and over. Sure. It's just different language. Yeah.
Yep.
Hey, what's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays, decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa, got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments, Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels, Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Especially Hong Sang-soo, for example.
Yeah.
But you know, like, so you know, want to get out of the country, you know, like, in the, you're very rebellious and like moved to Singapore to go into the education. Like, how was kind of Singapore for you? Because you basically made that your home base. I mean, even after education, after your university life, right? So, how was that? Cultural and school experience for you?
Singapore was special. I didn't plan to stay that long. It just happened. It's very different from Vietnam, firstly because it's a multiracial country. So there were a lot of things that I wasn't aware until I went to Singapore. For example, my friend was fasting. He's a Muslim. And I was asking him to eat, to share with me some like pork bun. Because I feel bad that he was not eating. I thought he didn't have enough money to eat for lunch.
Right. It was Ramadan.
That was, okay, in my defense, that was my first week in school. So yeah, I wasn't aware. Yeah. And now I know all about the nuances of all the multiracial cultures in Singapore. Sure. So that was one of the things that I had to adapt to. Also, the accent.
The accent, yeah.
Yeah. I felt that I could understand English well until I went to Singapore and I realized that it's a whole, it's an entire language by itself. It's called right. Singlish for us.
Yeah.
Because all the slang were made up of like different languages. It's just not, it's not just Chinese or Malay or, it's a mix of different accents and dialects from different cultures. So that actually brought me to quite a nice space where I could learn, you know, snippets of language from different cultures and understand what the meaning are and where they're coming from. Besides from that, filmmaking, when I was learning in Singapore, it was still very much academic. So we have to learn all the theories. And I think one of the differences between the Singapore system and the Vietnamese system is that we have to learn everything. Meaning, for example, if you go to the Academy of Theatre and Film in Hanoi, you can only learn to be a director or a screenwriter or a cinematographer.
Yeah.
But in Singapore, you have to learn to do everything. So I get to experience all the roles, like from being a sound man, PA, set dresser, stylist, everything, basically everything.
Yeah.
Before I just thought I tried to do directing.
Right. And you've worked on several films over, in different positions, right? Like you were like set dresser or editor or what have you. So how was that experience for you? Did that working on other people's films and trying to make the director's kind of vision a reality? How was that in being a supportive role in that sense?
Well, I think it's fantastic because I always think that if we want to work in a film set, we really need to understand each other's roles. So if you are in art department, it will be helpful to understand what's going on with the camera department as vice versa, because they all, affect each other in a way or another. And for me, when I was working as supporting roles for other people's film, I get to see things from the ground up.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like the struggles, the difficulties, the budget versus the vision, and all those things, all those not very beautiful things about a film set.
Yeah.
And also get my ego crushed a lot because back then I was young. And if you know, when you're young on a film set with very minimal experience, and when you do a wrong thing, it feels like the end of the world, you know.
Sure.
Yeah. But then I realized that, sometimes it's just about communication, working with each other and really understand from the other person's point of view. So that changed my mindset a little bit so that when I start directing my own films, I gain a lot of sympathies for other people working together with me. And it actually also helped that I understand how their role function so that I can incorporate that into my workflow for my film sets. For example, I've been working a lot as a sound man, so I know what a sound person would require on set. And sometimes, people on set, they think that like a sound man is like the least priority, right? It's like nobody's gonna stop 2 minutes for ambient, for instance.
Sound is the most important element.
I know. Yeah, I know. But like a lot of my Vietnamese sound people, they complain to me like, nobody want to stop for us. Like they can wait 2 hours for the camera department to set their lighting, but nobody can wait 2 minutes for the sound department to record. And so because I worked as sound man before, so I understand, the assignments, and then I can incorporate that into my film sets and vice versa, it's not just sound department, but like art department and everything. So I think that experience is very helpful. Yeah, definitely.
I think I read an interview where you and we'll touch upon your feature film, Don't Cry Butterfly. But yeah, I read an article, interview where you basically said that you talked about your workflow as a director, and that it's a very collaborative effort. You rely on the expertise of your crew, right? And it's I always joke around that, being a film directors, especially in the Western world, it's like, it's the last, job in the Western world where he can be a dictator, still be a dictator. But so I think that's really interesting in kind of when you talk about workflow and how you rely on other people to kind of be in their expertise to help craft your vision, right? So, and we'll touch on that when with the in later in the interview with your feature film. But okay, so you worked on various short films and whatnot, and then in different roles, sound as a sound person, as set dresser, you name it, and then you embark on your journey as a director, and you I think you directed three short films, five short films, excuse me. But you know, like I've seen were like A Trip to Heaven, Sweet Salty, Mother Daughter Dreams, you know. So talk about your going on to kind of your the next stage and being the director, and then how did you I assume especially when it comes to filmmaking, especially indie filmmaking, you know, you gain experience, but you also kind of gain network, you make contacts, and you work with people that you want to work with, right? So how did you kind of drum up that to kind of embark on your journey as a director?
I think it was during that period after I graduated, and then I've been working on other people's set for a while. So I've been always producing my friends' films. Yeah. I think back in uni, my self-esteem got crushed a little bit, and I always thought that I was not good enough to be a director. Mm-hmm. So I decided that, maybe I would help my friends make their films. And then I was just watching them making their films, telling their stories, and I was like, hey, I also have my own story to tell, and I really want to tell the story that is my own, from my own culture, my own language. And I think that was when I went back to Vietnam to shoot my first short film. And that was when I realized that, I am able to do it. I just have been doing it in the wrong place, because I have been, you know, making my school short films in Singapore, where they speak a different language, where they have different cultural backgrounds. And of course, I have been staying there for a while, but I wasn't really fully integrated into the society. And so it always feel like I was pretending, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So when I went back to Vietnam and making film with my friends, and just a very small little story about mother and daughter in Hanoi, it felt like home. It felt like I'm telling my story. And I guess that was when I realized that I could do this. And I gained, of course, like you said, I gained more confidence with each short film that I make, because I learned more of like what I'm more comfortable with. For example, I prefer a more humorous tone rather than being serious all the time. I tried making a serious film, which is Mother Daughter Dreams. Mm-hmm. And I still feel like it wasn't very comfortable. I felt like something about my film has to be part of me, and I'm very good at like using humor to disperse serious moments. It is this passive aggressiveness from where I was growing up in Hanoi. I think it was really influencing the way that I behave in daily life. So yeah, and then I also learned about the time where I was making Mother-Daughter Dreams, that it was becoming clear for me that, I was making these films to try to find an answer for something. I think I was just trying to understand myself and my relationship with other women in my life. Mm-hmm. And back then, I was still young and I didn't know how to express myself freely. So I was using my films as a way to express myself and to really understand myself. And that was where the bio come from. It was like, Ling was obsessed with like, you know, naggy, quirky, angsty, middle-aged women. Yes. And I think that was where it shaped my journey until now, making film about the same topic, the same subject matter, basically, but trying to find an answer.
Mm-hmm.
About their life and what they're trying to do and what are they dealing with. Yeah.
But like your I mean, your short films, the ones I just rattled off, like Mother Daughter Dream, Sweet Salty, A Trip to Heaven, they're all set in Vietnam, you know, and they're very, very, very much Vietnamese stories. You left Vietnam after high school, after graduation of high school, secondary school, and then you moved to Singapore. Was there reverse culture shock for you going back to Vietnam, because you're basically educated in different culture, even though it's like Southeast Asian, but it's different. It's like saying it was like multicultural, whatnot, the different so was there any reverse culture for you going back to Vietnam to work on these very Vietnamese stories?
Because I was away from Vietnam for a while, I was able to look at it in a more objective way.
Mm.
And it's kind of like when you have a distance from something, then you get to watch it from a bigger perspective. And you get to see things for what they are versus when you are inside of it and then you don't really have a clear view of it. But I have to agree that when I go back to Vietnam and try to, make friends again, it feels very, in a way, I felt very isolated because everybody who has grown up there or have been in the film scene since they were younger or they go to film schools together, they seem to have their own community and they all know each other versus me who, I left when I was 18 years old. I basically spent my early 20s in Singapore. And so when I come back, it's almost like I have to prove myself again. I have to show people that, hey, I'm this person, I'm trying to do this and could you help me? But people were very welcoming, so I didn't really have that kind of like culture shock, or I didn't really have to like struggle so much. Even when I went to Ho Chi Minh, I stayed there for 2 years because I really want to get to know the industry and I just want to see how things function in Vietnam and the different working style in Vietnam and Singapore. Mm. And I was just deciding where I want to be, in my life.
Right.
And people were really helpful. They just helped me. I went to Ho Chi Minh knowing nobody, and this one after another, they just keep helping me and welcome me into the community of filmmakers there.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of working style, it took me a while to get used to because in Singapore, the cost of making a film is very expensive. Mm-hmm. So unless you are working on a commercial set, if you are working on a film set, usually one person has to do many roles. It's right. Normal for like a DP to also operate the camera. It's also normal for us to only have one CA who does everything.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, like there's only like one AD who also have to double up at some other roles.
Right.
But advice, yeah, so on and so forth. But like when I go to Vietnam, we can afford more people.
Mm-hmm.
But it also means that when the crew get bigger, then you have to have better, management skills.
Mm-hmm.
To make sure everybody is fully focused and fully doing their roles and not just, being there to just do their job and that's it and they go home and forget about it. I think my aim is always for everyone to be able to fully immerse into the film so that they can not do things beyond their role but also be aware of what other people are doing. So that when there's a problem that emerges, they don't be like passive. Like, oh, there's a problem. Now we have to think of the problem. But they anticipate if there's a problem and they work together to solve the problem before it even happened. And I feel that that is something that I'm still trying to do with the crew in Vietnam. Because I feel that one thing that is very good that I learned, one skill that I learned in Singapore, working in Singapore, is the ability to take, initiative to really anticipate what is required of your role and think 10 steps ahead before it happens instead of staying passive. So I'm really trying to bring that to my team in Vietnam as well. It's not that everyone some people are really good taking initiative, but some I think I just need to show them how to do it and then they will think that it's very fun to do.
Yeah, I think there's more synergy Basically, it's simple. You know, you want the crew to have more incentive and also be a stakeholder in the overall production, mm-hmm. right? Like, so they're not like just in their lane, just doing one thing, and they don't mm-hmm. care about anything else, right? So, I think that's very important, especially your philosophy of workflow and whatnot. But another thing. Okay, so like for your short films, they eventually travel to festivals outside of Singapore, Vietnam, to some reputable festivals. You talk about in it's your bio that you participated, you applied and got accepted to various artist development labs, whatnot. And this is very important in kind of the crafting and the formation of you as a filmmaker, and learning, kind of developing your skill set and your kind of artistic vision. And I think that's an issue, especially not only in, because I go to Vietnam, I go to, I travel to other regions, and I meet young filmmakers here, and there are really a lot of talented filmmakers, especially in Vietnam. I think they're really talented, but there's that I would say that ignorance, so to speak, when it comes to, you have to do the research on what's out there, and there's opportunities to especially from not only film festivals, but also a lot of artist development labs and whatnot. And and can you talk about kind of were you already aware of these programs or festivals when you were making your short films, or was it more of an ongoing process?
I have always been aware of, actually when I was in school still, and my last 2 years of film school, back then I was already making a list. Okay, back then, there's no Facebook groups about, film festivals or film events or film labs to inform you and remind you like, oh, hey, there's this thing going on, please apply. Yeah. So back then, it's all like personal research. And I still have, like a Excel sheet with like all the dates of the year and all the grants and all the film festival and all the film labs that I'm supposed to apply for. Back then, I was very ignorant. I even put like World Cinema Fund in my list.
Yeah.
Not knowing that you have to reach a certain level in your development of feature film to apply for that.
Uh-huh.
I learned along the way. But basically, I have a list of all these festivals, short film festivals also, the major ones.
Mm-hmm.
And, remember back then, there was still like Short Film Report.
Yes.
Film Freeway, all these platform to submit a short film in. And I also applied for my for some festival on there, but it didn't really work. Actually, I prefer to just submit by myself through the festival's websites. So it was actually quite a painful process, all those applications. I'm sure you know about it, just apply for a film festival, you have to have your bio, your synopsis, your budget, your film crew, all in one page, and then submit. And different film festival, they ask for different information for the short film application. So I remember for each short film, I have to apply for at least 20, 30 film festival by myself until I'm tired. And then eventually when the little films Mother Daughter Dreams or Sweet Salty, they will pick up by bigger film festival, then there will be festival emailing me for the screeners. It became a bit easier. And especially with A Trip to Heaven, I had a sales agent for the short film. So I didn't have to do so much work as before. But when I was starting out, it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
And also a similar way with the film labs. So Puchon Film Festival and Locarno Filmmakers Academy were the two first ones that I got into. And it's almost like a snowball. So once you get into one, and then people start talking about others, and then you use the credit from that first lab
mm-hmm.
that you got into to get into others. So for example, I got into Locarno Filmmaker Academy in 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2016, when I applied for Asian Film Academy in Busan, I asked for a recommendation letter from the programmer of Locarno Filmmakers Academy, and I got into Busan Asian Film Academy. So it's just one thing after another. And for Berlinale Talent Campus is a few years later when I have already gotten my films into big festivals like Busan. And then I got into Berlinale Talents using that credit. So then I realized and I learned that it's a system of credibility, you know, of even for the film labs, you have to reach a certain level to get into certain labs. And that's fine. I mean, Berlinale Talent Campus, I think I applied 4 or 5 times. And you know, if you have already applied for that, you know that they ask 10,000 questions. Like, it's almost like very pensive, life challenging kind of questions. Like, what are you here for? What's your life purpose? Why are you making films? And every year I will go through that process, you know, answering all the questions, not knowing, you know, what the requirements were. At one point, I was like, what do you want from me? But then when I got to the level where I have some credibility and I know what I want to share with the people at the campus, then I got in. And then I realized, oh, so this is how it works. Yeah, but it takes trial and error. But I'm glad that I went through that process so that now I can share with the younger filmmakers.
Yeah.
You know, also this is how you should do it, and you know, don't waste your time with this and that. Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's not rocket science, so to speak. It's like you're just building your CV, you know, and then again, this is a recognition, you know, I'm getting, yeah. So but like, you know, I think it's like so what would you say? I mean, like, you know, I'd be looking at, like, you know, for me, because I work in the film festival world, and like, it's astounding to me how when I get, you know, filmmakers submit their films, and like how scant, how very little they have when it comes to materials, like, you know, just a bio or like a trailer or even like high-res images that attach to, like, those are just like simple like assets that are very important when it comes to submitting a film, right? So is there like kind of like a shorthand of things that, you know, that you want to impart advice to young filmmakers who want to apply to film festivals? Like, they should have their assets all set already and all that stuff, or?
Yes, this is a painful lesson. Because, yeah. You know, okay, I can understand from the filmmaker's point of view, because like making a film is hard, and you have to like prepare for the film, you have to edit the film, you have to make sure the sound is right, and then send it to the festival, which is also a painful process.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened to me, like when I got selected to a festival, they were starting to ask for like your biography, your synopsis, your high-res, your BTS. Yeah. And I was like, I have none. Can I just send like a screenshot from the film?
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like rummaging, like, oh my God, I have to write my bio now, you know, and like prepare almost like my CV. So yeah, sometimes in a way it was a bit ignorant of me that back then to think that like, oh yeah, people will just judge you based on your film. But then now I learned that, yeah, every film, during the post-production process, there should already be like a package. Just in case your film get into a festival, right? There should be a package. And even for A Trip to Heaven, we have a film press kit where we have the log line synopsis and some simple question and answer about the film to send out to the festival, so they can already, you know, prep themselves for some of the content, or even when they want to introduce the film at the festival, because, you know, they don't want to keep using the same material over and over again.
Yeah.
And it's very helpful also for the festival to also know the filmmakers, not just on the film, but also on the personal level. Mm-hmm. So we did that for A Trip to Heaven, and also we did that for Don't Cry Butterfly. Because, of course, Don't Cry Butterfly, we have a longer press kit with all the more detailed question and answer set. But even for short film, it's a good practice to have that in hand. It's also like preparing the filmmakers mentally for the Q&A session, so that, you know, when we go and people start asking you all these like very deep questions, then you already have an answer in your mind. Yeah.
Again, this, a lot of this stuff is all format, you know, it's a template, you know, so you can find a lot of the template online, and what is required, like a log line, a short synopsis and all that stuff, right? So, I think I encourage filmmakers to, especially if you want to embark on this journey, just all this stuff is all available online, you know, so, And then also, like, you know, when you're going to, and let's talk about kind of like kind of your artistic journey when you're participating in these film labs or whatnot. Like, you're meeting different people. You're meeting mentors, but also your mentees, people who are also like you in the same boat as young filmmakers as well. It's also, you know, like you're educating yourself. You're meeting people from different parts of the world, but you're also making contacts. You're building your network. You're learning to feel like, okay, great. These are people that I want to, that could, you know, that are like-minded, but also could help me on my journey as well. So maybe just really quickly talk about kind of your participating in these various labs, and you've participated in a lot of them. What were some of the things that you learned that helped you along the way?
I think labs are a great place to meet people who are going through the same journey and the same struggles. And so, like, automatically, we have a lot of things to talk about, but we are all different people coming from different backgrounds. So we have different kind of struggles, but the same, essentially, we have the same goal, which is to make our films. So it's interesting because one of the first film labs that I go through was with some Southeast Asian filmmakers and East Asian filmmakers. And right now, at the moment, we are all in very different places in life. And some of them become producers, some of them become like filmmakers like me. And most of us, we all have our first feature film already done. And looking back, it's been like 5-7 years since we first met. And now we all have our first feature film. And now we're all, you know, all some of them even have like 2-3 films already. And then moving on to the next step in life. And it's almost feeling like very encouraging to see that, oh, they could do it, so I could do it. You know what I mean? And we are, how do I say this? We don't just stop at the labs, because right now, especially in the Southeast Asian region, we always meet each other because we have many film festivals in the region. We also have like film labs for participants only in the region. And we have all this cultural exchange and we meet each other all the time. And it becomes like this lifelong friendship that we have sprouted from the labs, and now it's going to follow us. And I never underestimate all this connection that I get in the labs, because you never know at which point in your life they will come in very handy. You will never know, you know, one day maybe you want to shoot a film in Switzerland, for example, and then you have all this contact in Switzerland, you can just ask them what's going on, what happened. For instance, I met last year in Oxbelly in Greece, a participant who was from Vancouver. And they were from different labs, but I was like just saying, hey, I might be going to Vancouver. Back then I was still waiting for my study permit, so I wasn't sure I was coming here.
Right.
I just say, hey, I might be going to Vancouver, and they're like, yeah, okay, come over and hit me up. And we didn't really talk that much after that, because we are from different parts of the lab. But then I got my study permit, I moved to Vancouver, and she has been one of the most important person for me here, because she helped me set up everything from scratch. So you will never know, you know, like when you will cross paths with the other person again. And back to the film labs, I think my batch growing up was with many of the emerging Southeast Asian filmmakers in the region now. So, for example, Amanda Neil from Malaysia.
Oh, yeah.
Bradley Liu and Bianca from Philippines.
Bianca Babuena,
And Mark Boon, Julia, we all met in the same kind of system of labs at the same time.
Right.
And of course, some are more prolific than the others. Like, for example, Mark Boon, Amanda, and me, or some other filmmakers, we are all directors. So we have all made our first feature film, and now we are preparing for our second feature films. And these are the other producers. They have made many feature films before. When they go to this lab and they met with us, it's almost like we introduce ourselves and our vision. And I think that's how I met Sue and my producer for Don't Cry Bird of Life.
Yes.
We met the first time was in Locarno Open Doors in 2019. But okay. She was there representing a project, and I was there just to show my film. I was in the screening program. I was very free. And we didn't really talk back then, but we just acknowledged each other. And then later that year, when I actually won the award for Don't Cry, Wanna Fly to go into a residency project in France. And then we meet again in Singapore. Then we have that connection because we have been to the same lab. She has seen me winning the award at the same lab.
Yeah.
I have seen her at the same lab. And then the conversation just start going on very easily because we kind of have that connection together.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if I have to give an advice for the young filmmaker starting out, it's really just to go to as many labs as possible to build the connections and also to watch films. Oh yeah, the very important part is because you go to all this lab, you also get access to the film festival and you get to watch a lot of films. And actually that was where I learned all the different film language, especially in the Europe region that I'm not very familiar with because I've been watching a lot of Asian films.
Got it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then like, again, you know, like, and of course it's very expensive too, but that's why there are a bunch of these labs, they give, stipends, they give travel stipends, whatnot, housing, you know, so it's just trying to make it work and try to cobble together. So there's definitely opportunities to do that. And, let's talk about basically Don't Cry Butterfly, your first feature length film. You met your producers, Cien Tan, who's like, you know, and she's also, you know, based in Singapore, but you became more close overseas in these labs, right? So like, it's like, and it's funny. I think that's very funny. But Don't Cry Butterfly has co-production with different countries. So can you kind of which countries are part of the part of the production?
Okay. Don't Cry Butterfly. Suan is Singaporean, so we obviously Singapore is one of the main production company. And also we got the grant from the Singapore Co-production Fund.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one Singapore. We also got a private investor from the Philippines, Fusi. Mm-hmm. So that's our second producer. And then we also have Julia, who also went to Locarno Open Doors.
Yeah.
From Indonesia, Kawan.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the three main countries.
Okay.
We also have some private investor from the UK, and also some grants, Purin Pictures from Thailand.
Yeah.
Yes, and we have the Vision Sudas grant, but I believe that one didn't require a co-producer.
Okay.
So we just apply and we got it. Yeah, so I think Don't Cry Butterfly has a very special model compared to a lot of Vietnamese independent films who rely heavily on grants.
Mm-hmm.
We went to quite a number of markets and we also talked to European co-producers. It's just that I think me and Suan, we decide in the end that we want to work with people who really believe in our vision and who really see the film for the film first before the benefit that the film can bring to them. Because many, you know, if you talk to enough co-producers, you can tell who are into the film for the film and the filmmaker and who just seeking for how much money can I make out of your film. Of course, that's important because we are in the film industry, but I think because it's a first feature film and it's very personal project for me. So we prioritize the kind of human connection than the money talk. And that's where we decided to just work with collaborators from the Southeast Asian region mainly.
Yeah.
Because we share the same, you know, culture, and especially the monster in the film is also inspired by a Filipino mythical creature.
Right.
So we have that kind of language going on together. Yeah, and it kind of worked out just that way. So even the post-production of Don't Cry Butterfly happens purely in Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm.
We had the editing in Singapore, color grading in Singapore, sound mix in Thailand, and visual effects in Philippines.
Mm.
Yeah.
Really quickly, can you maybe give us the log line for Don't Cry Butterfly? Or maybe a short kind of description. I can read it off right now. I'll read it off.
Okay. It's fine. So Don't Cry Butterfly is a dark comedy with a bit of a horror element about a middle-aged woman who finds out that the husband is having an affair But instead of confronting him, she goes to meet a voodoo master and try to cast a love spell with the hope that he will change his heart, not knowing that it will manifest an omnibus creature in their house.
Yeah, a very mysterious house spirit. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's only visible to the women, right?
Yeah, it's only visible to the women.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's like, yeah, really, I think it's a really cool film. And and it, look, I mean, talk about, you know, hitting it out of the park, so to speak. It world premieres in one of the most prestigious film festivals in the world, the Venice Film Festival. So talk about that journey. Talk about the announcement when you found out that you got accepted to Venice.
Okay. I still could remember clearly. Actually, if you ask me, I honestly, this is my reaction. I was like, because back then, when we got the news that we was accepted to Venice, we were still in post production of the film. I was still
finishing the film.
I was still crunching every day on the subtitles, right, translation. Right. Yeah. On the visual effect that were not done fully, and then on the sound design was done in April, but basically there was still visual aspect that we were trying to like compile and make polish. And I'm a very particular person. Like if you ask my team about how many times I changed my subtitles just to make sure they're all in the same format, yeah. So back then it's all nitty gritty details. And when we got the news, of course I was happy. But I think Suan and the sales agent were more happy than me because I was like, oh no, now I go into the festival, I must make the film.
You actually have a deadline. Yeah, you actually have a deadline. Yeah, yeah.
And I must make sure that it looks good, you know, for the audience.
Yeah.
So the pressure was still there. I think I was only be able to fully feel relief.
Yeah.
After the film was screened, and after all the Q&A were done. Then I was feeling okay. So now the film is done. Oh, but then still, because in Venice, the subtitles were kind of like fast. So I was like, can we do the subtitles slower for Toronto? I think for filmmakers' mind, you know, and I think for me, I really try to make everything as polished as possible.
Yeah.
So that was what going on in my mind all the time. Yeah. The journey there, I feel that for submissions, why a lot of people ask us like how did you submit, then I could only say that we had a sales agent before all the festival submissions, so it was taken care of by the sales agent, and then all the discussion on which festival to go to, which section is done by the sales agent. So I wasn't involved because I trust that, you know, they would choose what's best for the film. Yep. And for me,
yep.
I think, oh, what was memorable for me also was when I call each of the main cast to inform them
about the news
selection.
Yeah.
Yeah, the news. And it was a while, like when it was about to be announced, and I could inform them because we need to prepare for the trip and we had to know who's coming to Venice and who doesn't.
Right.
And when I called them, and it was so funny because each of them would react differently.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, Wang, our lead actress, she was happy, but she was so happy that she didn't catch the festival's name. And she was like, I'm sorry, but I know we got into some big festival, but what was the name again? And I think the younger younger actors, they were acting cool. Like they were like, sure. Oh, okay. And I think that the joy came later.
Sure.
I think only when they got to Venice and then they realized how it is.
Yeah.
And they would be like, oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was happy because I think I was just feeling happy that everyone was there in Venice, you know, even the sound designer, they were staying in Europe, so they flew over. Mm-hmm. And our DP was there, our fashion designer was there, our main cast, they could all make it. So it's almost like a first reunion after the shoot.
Yeah.
For the film. And of course, after that, we went to some other festivals together. And then the release in Vietnam, so we met each other again.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Venice was very special in that way.
Mm. Yeah, and it traveled to other major festivals and whatnot, Toronto, Busan, you name it. Like, how was the do you see different reactions for different audiences from these different festivals?
Definitely.
Anything unique or?
It's different. I guess it's just different culture and different understanding of the region. Because I mean, in the end, it's still a Vietnamese film, and a lot of the culture is very Southeast Asian based.
Yeah.
So when we show in Venice, the audience were mainly festival goer, right? They were also a bit like older in terms of age, and the subtitles wasn't the best because. It was the English subtitle was very fast.
Too fast, right.
Yeah, because it was like in Venice, there would be like Italian subtitles on screen, and then the English subtitle is on a separate platform below the screen. Yeah. Yeah. So it's a bit difficult to catch both. Even for me, I couldn't catch all the subtitles.
Right.
So I feel that some of the humor was lost, but people were still laughing and giggling and stuff, and some of the audience were shocked during that scene, you know, the scene where the house spirit fully appear.
Sure.
I think they didn't see it coming. So that was fun to watch. Some audience were just like covering their eyes, or some just like straight up walk away.
Well, I mean, like, I think that's great. I think it's burying the lead, so to speak. Cause, like, you know, it is, you mean with the way the film is, like, you think it's just a straightforward drama with the mother and daughter, but then you're like, what's happening? You know, like, it's like,
yeah. I didn't sign up for this.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah.
Toronto was different. Toronto, the audience went crazy.
No, nice.
I remember there was one night that the screening lasts until after midnight. So, like, many people would, I mean, if I was them, I would rush to the last train or last bus, right? But go stay for the Q&A. Yeah. And they were laughing and clapping, and they were like, whoo! At the very last scene.
Yeah.
And I think they're just fully, like, very amused. But it's not just my film. I think because I also watched other films at Toronto.
Sure.
And the audience were really enthusiastic, and they were just, like, really into it.
Well, Toronto has the best audiences, for sure.
Yeah. It was really fun. Busan or let's say Hong Kong or Taiwan, the East Asian countries, it's very interesting because the reaction on the surface seems mild because they don't laugh out loud, they're just giggling.
Yeah.
But the question and answers, they ask the smartest questions.
They do.
And they really understand the character in depth. And the most interesting thing is that many of the people who ask questions or love the film were male audience.
Interesting.
Yeah. I think from my understanding is because in Western country, the men, they don't really have to go through the toxic masculinity the same way as in patriarchal country in Asia to go through.
Mm-hmm.
So like the male audience in the Asian they really feel the pain of the male characters in the film. which is like, yeah, I did it. Because I really don't want people to think that, hey, this is a female woman, a female director making a, you know, woman film, hating on men because the men, of course, cheat, right?
Yeah.
That was my last goal. I really want people to also feel the pain of the men. And then they did. So I was very happy. Yeah, and of course, in Southeast Asia, people... this is where the film comes from. So, of course, the audience reaction were crazy as well because they totally get it. Like, the moment the house spirits appeared, they were like, yeah!
That's right.
Yeah, so it's interesting to watch the film with the audience and just to see the reaction.
And then the film would eventually be released theatrically in Vietnam. So,
yeah.
Just talk about kind of the Vietnamese reaction and the audience's reaction.
I have to say, I mean, whoever says that Vietnamese audience don't understand films, they're wrong. Because the Vietnamese audience, some of them, they wrote the most thorough, in-depth, like, they analyzed the film, every single small details, all the Easter eggs that I put inside, they got it. They got it totally. And I was like, wow. I didn't expect this, like, because I think my film, in a way, even with the international audience, it's always been like two very extreme end. Either they love it to death or they just straight up, I don't get this, what is this? Yeah. And I'm fine. It's like, I'm fine. Because, you know, when you make a film and you make people think, these things bound to happen. And in Vietnam, it's similar. Like, the people who really love and support the film, they wrote, like, very detailed, how to say, they were trying how do I say this? They were really trying to analyze certain, like, idea that I put in the film or certain images that was not, I guess you need to have a certain kind of understanding of psychology to really fully understand. Yeah. And so people who have all this knowledge, they write down on how they analyze the film. And so the audience who went to watch the film and like the film but don't really understand the film read, and they'll be like, oh, so this is what it means.
Right. It's great. When you do, I mean, it's very thorough critical breakdowns from their point of views, right? And how they interpret.
And like, I also have audience who straight up message me on social media because I, you know, I put my profile public, even my Instagram handle. So they do message me personally. And sometimes they just ask me, so what is the meaning of the ending? And I could answer them. Or sometimes they just say like, yeah, I liked your film. And it feels really heartwarming. I feel and because it is a Vietnamese film, when I show it to Vietnamese audience, I was very nervous at first because, you know, if you were being pretentious, you cannot hide. Because if you pretend, maybe you can bluff the international audience, but for your local audience, they can spot it immediately. If you are trying to, you know, exoticize certain ideas or you just putting something in to make it appeal to international audience.
Mm-hmm.
So for my film, I'm so glad that we didn't have that. We didn't have to get that criticized. And it's all, the audience were very supportive. Yeah.
I think it's more like, you know, I think that in the end of the day, it's like if it's, I mean, you know, like, I use this word often, like authenticity is very, very important. That's like, you know, even though if it's a film that has a lot of ideas, you know, it's also very local and it's very Hanoian too, I think. Maybe kind of different. I mean, you look at Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh, like North and South, like it's very different culturally at times as well, you know, so. And I think it's like, I think that's what's, there's that feeling of it being authentic, you know? And I think that's really important. But that's great. I mean, like, and then just one, and congratulations on everything. But like, you know, it's one, I think I just want to bring up one more thing, you know, during the pandemic, you know, I think you wrote this article that was posted by the Motion Picture Association. Titled My Blueprint for a Dynamic Flourishing Vietnamese Film Industry, and you came up with like I think a 9-point system, right?
Or something. 7 or 9.
7. Well, I mean, I'm bad with numbers. I'm like, you made 3 films. No, you made 5 short films. But like, you know, like you came up with a multi, like, you know, like a numbered system, you know, points of breaking down what would be making a vibrant Vietnamese film industry. Can you talk about what compelled you to do that, and also was it and then where did you come up with these ideas to kind of come up with this system? And this, by the way, this article everyone can read online, and we'll put the link into the description.
Okay, so back then, 2019, it was when I just won the prize by MPA. To go to attend the American Film Market in a short filmmaking course in LA. And so after I returned from that trip, I think that was when they asked me, so maybe what I've learned
or what I have have observed and what I could do to maybe help the Vietnamese film industry now that I've, you know, gone out and see things from a different point of view.
Yeah.
So that was when I wrote the article. And some of the ideas we were discussing in a way, so the some of the plot points were also suggested. And the wording was mine because it's a point to think about, but then I went to do my own research and then I wrote the articles the way that I could see. Of course, now reading back, some of the ideas were still a bit naive because, you know, back then I was still, it was 5 years ago.
And obviously the market changed. So, you know, market case formed too, like, you know, there's been disruptions and whatnot. So, but yeah, I think the ideas are still, I think even though it was written several years ago, I still think while your points are very, very necessary and then very good points.
Yeah. So I think one of the biggest points that I think or the overall feeling I had was that, you know, the film industry in Vietnam, of course, it's like a system. And, you know, it's not just the filmmakers by themselves trying to make the film industry happen. It's also have, you know, the supports from the our government and also the supports from the film production company and also, you know, the film distributors within Vietnam itself. Yeah. And it has to be like a system that really support each other. And because I just witnessed how other countries were doing it. For example, let's just look at, you know, the most obvious, example, Korea, South Korea, because they were thinking of a way to really promote their culture, mm-hmm. and they use film as one of the mediums to really heighten their culture. They really use, even like from their TV series that they were showing us, and then to, you know, entertainment industry, all the music bands or idols, mm-hmm. and then to filmmaking. They were just putting in bits and pieces of their culture into their work, and it's been supported. Like, for example, you know, the tourism board, they were supporting all the location of the film shoot so that, you know, there'll be tourists coming to all these destinations.
Yeah.
So they were very welcoming of towards filmmakers to shoot the film in different regions in the country. Or, you know, even the how would I say this? The government was very supportive in the sense that they would really encourage different kind of topics, different kind of like ways of telling the stories, and not limited to any genre. Mm-hmm. You know, that if you look at the South South Korea, you know, film industry, there's so many kind of freedom for them to write their script, for them to, you know, work on different difficult topics to talk about, even political topics. Of course, there were limitations.
Sure.
But there was some leeway for them to talk about political topics. Then, and you know, like the distributors, the South Korea distributors appear even in like Vietnam, Indonesia, all the Southeast Asian countries. Now there are so many CGVs, you know, so many Lottes everywhere.
Yeah.
And of course, they would bring their own films to show, you know, everywhere. And of course, people would buy the tickets and just to support their... So I'm not saying that, like, okay, Vietnamese, you know, have to open all cinema and show films.
No.
We don't have, we don't have the money to do that.
Sure.
Maybe one day when we are strong enough as an industry, we could think about doing that. But now I think it's just focusing on supporting each other. Because at the moment, I feel that there's a disconnection in a way. It's like filmmaker is trying to do this thing and then, you know, it's different from the agenda of the film distributor, different from the agenda of the government, for example. And then everyone is just running their own agendas.
Right.
Whereas we all have the same agenda to, you know, promote and to really improve the even the quality of the film production, mm-hmm. and the quality of the script writing and the quality of, you know, the visuals and the audio and the system of the cinemas to be better. Everything will go up. And as you can see, the Vietnamese audience really crave for Vietnamese content.
Yeah.
As proven over the past few years.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, of course, like, you know, it's like looking at South Korea, everyone looks at South Korea and whatnot. And like, you know, it's like, but it's not a apples to apples comparison. You know, it's a different country.
It's true.
I mean, all that stuff. Yeah. But I think what is the opportunity is that, you know, because Vietnam is ever, you know, constantly changing. What's great, there's an opportunity here because the audiences, and I'm thinking just purely for the theatrical audience, like the movie business, theatrical distribution is very still growing in Vietnam, and the audiences are very, very young. So they, you know, they want, they're craving to, you know, different perspectives, different stories, whatnot, and local Vietnamese stories too. And I think that's very, very important. So I think it's like, you know, just take that opportunity, you know, that there's like a lot of room for growth, right? So, yeah. But, you know, yeah. So I think, and we can talk for hours regarding this stuff, but like, you know, we don't have much time. I think we have to close our conversation here. But just one of my final kind of question is like, what are you working on next? You're based in Vancouver now, you know, for the time being. What are you working on next?
Yeah, so, okay, I'm going to keep this short. Basically, after shooting Don't Cry Butterfly and while doing like post-production, I was thinking like what I want to do next and what I want to be next, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to go somewhere else because I had been staying in Singapore for half of my life
mm-hmm.
back then, right? Yeah. 17 years in Vietnam, 17 years in Singapore. And it's like, okay, maybe it's time to move. So I want to kind of slow down a little bit because I had been spending 5 years on Don't Cry Butterfly nonstop. It's almost like it's always something on my mind all the time, and I don't have time to think of something else. And you know, as a creative person, you really want to always think of something new to do, new topics, new language, new ways of doing things. And that's why I signed up to be here in the double degree program. So I'm not only studying filmmaking, but also creative writing.
Okay.
And yeah, I've been learning different forms of writing. Yes?
More school?
Yeah, but I'm enjoying it, actually. I'm even taking like acting classes so that I can talk to my actors better. And it's really, really great. I think all directors should take acting classes.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, okay. Just understand from the actor's point of view and how they process the information differently from us. So yeah, I'm just here to nurture my craft. In a way, finding new topics, learning writing from the scratch again, learning writing not from just an instinct point of view, because I wrote Don't Cry Butterfly based on purely instinct.
Got it.
Because I refuse to follow the book. And now I'm just learning the techniques and the book.
Right, sure.
So that I can break the rules again, but knowing that there are rules to follow. So I think it's very helpful in that sense that like I'm just taking some time for myself and working on my craft. And of course, I do have some new idea for new project, but at the moment, they're still staying as ideas stage.
Mm-hmm.
So I cannot disclose yet. Hopefully, we can hear something soon in the future.
Sure. Yep. I mean, it's great. I think it's just part of your kind of worldview, your perspective of... again, being very holistic in your approach to your craft, you know, like you've occupied various positions on the, you know, like on the film set, like as a, you know, again, from the set designer to, you know, a PA to, you know, and then now you're wanting to learn about taking these acting classes. So to basically, it's all about communication, how best to communicate your vision as a filmmaker, right? So
yeah,
I think it's great that you have all these multitudes and then you're becoming truly a multi-hyphenate, you know, in that sense. So but like, you know, again, you know, a lot of these films are that your filmography I you know, some of your short films are available on various streaming sites, I think. Is there a book for Don't Cry Butterfly? It's been on the festival circuit, you know. I think it'll eventually be on a streaming platform in North America, hopefully soon. But is there any other ways for our listeners to our viewers to follow you and your journey? Mm-hmm. Basically, just here, basically following you on Instagram, or
yeah, sure. I mean,
It was like a...
Yeah, I mean, I have my Facebook and my Instagram. I post mostly my work-related stuff on Facebook because that's where all my film industry friends are. Instagram is a bit more personal, but yeah, I'm often tagged on like film content there. For Don't Cry Butterfly, yeah, hopefully one day it will go to... We're hoping for a theatrical release around the world first.
Great.
Before streaming platform, we do have some countries in the list.
Good.
And then we do have a fan page for Don't Cry Butterfly, so you can follow our updates. Yeah.
Yeah, like, I think that's a perfect, like, can you, and we'll put the description in the link to the fan page for Don't Cry Butterfly. So,
yeah,
great. Well, thank you very much, Lynn. Thank you so much for taking time for this interview. And then I wish you great success, and I look forward to what's next in store for you.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
If you're an HVAC technician and a call comes in, Grainger knows that you need a partner that helps you find the right product, fast and hassle-free. And you know that when the first problem of the day is a clanking blower motor, there's no need to break a sweat. With Grainger's easy-to-use website and product details, you're confident you'll soon have everything humming right along. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.